She also has a problem if she has a history of psychological breakdown, therapy, or what have you. Since women are more likely to seek therapeutic help than men, because men see it as a sign of weakness, women are more vulnerable in that area in terms of the court having being made aware of whatever history they may have in terms of psychological imbalance, or whatever you want to call it. Women have less money than men in general. Women who have been dependent financially on their husbands find themselves in court oftentimes inadequately represented because they think they're going to win, number one, because they're good mothers, and after all, why shouldn't I win? Women always win, and I haven't done anything wrong. And in my opinion, what determines the outcome in child custody battles or anything that goes on in family court is not what's fair and what's right, but I think it has a lot to do with power and money. And men who can go out and hire fancy lawyers who have high-powered reputations in the eyes of the court, who can provide a three-bedroom house in the suburbs as opposed to a one-bedroom apartment in the city, end up looking much better in the eyes of the court, which is, of course, considering, quote, the best interest of the child. So saying all this to say that women are very vulnerable when it comes to child custody in ways that they're not aware of. And one of the things that we invariably stress is the need for adequate representation in a custody battle. Before we get to that point, however, we try to bring up with the woman her concepts about her mothering, what the needs of the child are, and we try to help her examine her approach. If we feel that the woman is being unreasonable in terms of granting visitation rights or in terms of who the children are going to be with, we encourage her to reevaluate her position. We advocate a concept of shared custody, whereby, and the courts are starting to recognize this now, whereby the husband and the wife sit down and they decide that the children are not property to belong to either parent, but that they are human beings and that each parent has an equal responsibility towards the child, and that they will share the responsibility as equally as possible. Now, I know in Freud's book, they don't like that idea, but we have found it to work extremely well for many women who have come through our program, myself included. I've done this myself. And it may be difficult logistically to work out, particularly when the children are school age. It's easier when they're preschool and they can sort of go back and forth between parents more simply. But when they're school age, it does require some working out. For example, in my situation, my husband picks the kids up on Friday after he gets out of work, and he brings them back Monday morning before school, and then he spends maybe an evening or two during the week with them. It could just as easily be the other way around, and I think that we would both feel that we were getting enough time with our children, that we were both contributing significantly to rearing them, and that neither one of us was being pushed aside and considered the secondary parent. So if the husband and wife are on speaking terms, we encourage women to remain that way, and if possible, to come up with an out-of-court agreement about what's going to happen to the children, preferably one that where the custody is shared equally. If it's impossible to do that, then we recommend that women provide visitation for the husbands, no matter how ill they may think of him. And of course, our line for that is that if he's a oh, I can't say that on the air. Sorry. if he's not a very nice person, the children will come to realize that on their own, and that she doesn't have to fill up their heads with it, and she doesn't have to deny them access to him, that she should have enough confidence in herself to know that if she is a good person and he's not, the children will come to see that. And that's one of the main problems that we run up against psychologically in women around custody, is their lack of self-confidence and the lack of a positive self-image. And this also contributes to the bitterness, I think, extremely, because women who feel that their husbands have really been totally unfair to them feel that it is even more unfair that he should have the children on weekends without having responsibility for them, without having to discipline them. Maybe she's working full time and she has them all week and she's irritable and she's tired and she comes out looking like the baddie. And daddy comes around on the weekends and he has more money and he takes them places and he becomes the Santa Claus. And many women, we call that the glorification of the absent parent. And I think many women are really controlled by that and are very bitter about the image that the father is getting in, what they think the image the father is getting in the child's mind, as opposed to their own image. But once again, we try and urge women to stick it out and to have confidence in themselves, and that the child will eventually come to see the things that the mother offers the child as well as the things that the father offers the child. Another problem I think that women who have primary custody face is the lack of the male image in the home, which we hear a lot about, that it is assumed that when there is no male in the house, that the child is going to be stunted, or that the child is not going to be developed fully, or that there's a great lack in the child's life. And I think that while it's important for children to have positive models of either sex, I think that part of the thinking that underlies that assumption is that women are incapable of performing or raising children or providing certain examples to their children. I think that it is assumed, for example, that women will not be able to demonstrate athletic ability to their children, or won't demonstrate enough strength or enough self-confidence or aggressiveness or whatever. And people think that there needs to be a man in the child's life to impart these qualities to the child. And I would take issue with that. I feel that women are capable of imparting to children what they need to develop into complete human beings, just as I think men are. And I think that a lot of women are controlled by the sort of nagging doubt that because there is no male in their child's life, that something is necessarily wrong. So we try to offset some of that kind of thinking on the part of the women who come to us. A couple of the terms that you used in your paper I would take issue with. I think that it's difficult to define things like excessive closeness and excessive distance, or you mentioned mothers being neglectful, but you mentioned nothing about fathers being neglectful. And I think that might be an oversight on your part, in that although women are the ones who are always having to deal with the neglectful mother accusation, either overt or subtle, it is in fact men who have neglected their children through the centuries by disappearing when things get tough, by taking off, by not supporting their children, by fathering too many to support adequately. So I think that whenever people are talking about neglect, that it's important to mention both sexes when that's brought up, because I think when you mention only mothers and neglect, it reinforces that whole stereotype that, you know, and the whole cultural assumption, once again, that women are biologically destined to be the primary parent. And that, of course, is an issue that, an assumption that we take issue with. Cynthia, you wanted me to talk about the legal aspects. I don't know whether I've really covered that.
Go on, yeah, time.
We have the kidnapping syndrome, which is recently attracting attention in the press, where since the law states that unless there's a court order specifying otherwise, both parents have equal access to the child, a parent cannot kidnap his or her own child. So we have women call us whose husbands come and take the kids, and they go and they steal the kids back, and the child is being kidnapped back and forth between parents. Many women call up thinking that men, their husbands, cannot steal the children, that somehow that is kidnapping, and we have to inform them otherwise. We do not encourage women to do that sort of thing unless there has been a grossly unfair awarding of the children to the father, or the father is being grossly unfair and has denied her access to the children and she has no alternative. We always encourage women to try and negotiate as much as possible to avoid getting to this point. Although there are times, I think, when those kinds of methods have to be used, unfortunately, and I think that that's probably true for both the fathers and the mothers. Until the turn of the century, interestingly enough, men got automatic custody of children. There was no, although divorce, of course, was much less common than it is now, when it did happen, there was no question about who the children belonged with. The children belonged with the father because the whole family was the father's property. Children, most of all, wives too. So, around the turn of the century, I think along with the rise in the romantic notions of childhood and children came this concept that young children belonged with the mother rather than the father. So the legal tradition of women being preferred in custody battles is only recently established, and believe me, it does not work when the children are over 10 or 12 or 13 years old. Then it is much more equal. For women who decide that they would rather that the children spend most of their time with the father, we have special groups for those women because they go through incredible amounts of guilt and self-doubt and self-accusation and self-recrimination, although they, on the surface, understand intellectually that they may very well be doing the best thing for themselves and the child and the father, they still are subject to the motherhood myth. And we try and provide a supportive environment for women who make that choice. We try to hook them up with other women who are making the same choice so that they can see that they're not monsters, so that they can see that there are other women who have done it, maybe done it years ago, that their children turn out well-adjusted, happy, and successful. But that's a difficult decision, I think, for any woman to reach. And although it is happening more and more, and we encourage women to consider that alternative along with all the others. Okay, so I think I'm done, pretty much. Did I run over 15?
A little bit, that's all right. Our next speaker is going to be Rosalie Davies from CALM, which is the Custody Action Group for Lesbian Mothers.
Custody Action for Lesbian Mothers.
I always get it incorrectly. Okay, Custody Action for Lesbian Mothers.
Well, I want to talk first about the most recent approach, which is considered, well, first, I'm going to do basically legal approach to custody. And the most recent attitudes that the courts, that the women's movement is bringing to the courts and is beginning to be shown in the courts, and also which Jennifer has been talking about, that mothers don't always get their children, and more they don't get their children because new standards are coming in which say that you look at both parents. An assumption is being made that a father can be a good parent, and if he can show himself to be a good parenting figure, then, and also can show, he always can show that he can provide, or most frequently can show that he can provide an equal or better economic situation to raise the children in, then the courts tend to give the children to the father. There have been the gay rights bills that have been passed around the country have not helped this situation at all. They address themselves to public accommodation and equal employment rights. They do not address themselves to any area that involves custody. There's a new law that has just, bill that is just about to be passed in Washington that does just, is the first time any legislation has addressed itself to child custody and the issue of sexual orientation. It's not a very strong bill, but it does say that in areas of sex, race, and sexual orientation, that this issue alone cannot be a reason for taking a child out of the home. To talk a little personally, I first found out the position of lesbian mothers when I was about to have a custody battle of my own for my children and started to work on doing research. One of the things I found is that there's almost nothing published in this area. And there's still almost nothing published in this area. And until 5 years ago, lesbian mother cases were done in a very secret way in a judge's chambers. The judges felt that it was very important not to put the scandal on the family. The lesbian mother didn't want to use the word lesbian attached to herself. And the standard legal methods for searching and doing research had no key number. A key number is where you look for a topic. To research cases. So under the word lesbian or under child custody, there was never any reference. So that if you wanted to build a case and have authority, there was no authority. And then some friends of mine who are part of the new women lawyers coming out of law schools today, and that's also a phenomenon of the probably the last 4 or 5 years, have diligently searched until they have found these cases. And the cases that have been found were 90% against me, 95% against me, which left me in a horrendous position and very scared. And I lost my children in that case, and I realized that something had to be done about it, which was how CALM came into existence. There have been two major cases that have gone in our favor. Both of these cases, interestingly enough, have had two mothers, each with a group of children, living together in a lesbian relationship. Generally speaking, we tend to advise our clients not to live with their lover because you have more chance of getting custody if you're not actively a lesbian. The judge will think it's fine if you're a Saturday night lesbian and the children don't know about it. But if you've actually incorporated your sexual orientation into the home, then he gets very upset. I have a feeling that the reason these two cases went as far as they did was that the mothers economically couldn't afford to do anything else but live together. In the first case, the judge said that they could keep their children, but that they had to live apart, that they could babysit each other's children. It's very important that they live apart. So they moved into apartments across the hall from each other, and each night families moved back and forth. And the two husbands, in this case incidentally, sued the mothers jointly. It's also an example of what Jennifer was talking about. The husbands have never really shown any real interest in having the children, but a great deal of interest in harassing their ex-wives. So the husbands went back to the court and said that these mothers were not keeping to the spirit of the decision, that they were really living together. So the whole case was litigated again, and the judge said that they could live together. So they all moved in together. Whereupon they were so overjoyed by their situation that they made this movie called Sandy and Madeline's Family, which was distributed in the women's movement, showing the new lesbian nuclear family. Their husbands took them back into court and said that they were propagandizing their lifestyle and that that wasn't right for the children. And again, it was found in their favor. My understanding is that there's a new case coming in right now and that the husband's again litigating it, and I'm not even sure what the issue is this time.
Excuse me, Rosalie, do they have the same judge throughout each of these litigation processes?
No.
Okay.
The other major case that was won again was two women with a whole bunch of children. I think they had 8 children between them. And one of the mothers lost her children, and they put the children into an institution, and the mother was not allowed to speak to them for a whole year, which is why the case was in appeal, which I think was one of the cruelest situations. I've also read of situations where children of lesbian mothers are put into institutions and constantly run away and come home, and the judge is put them right back into the institutions. The most recent decision, and the sanest decision we've had, came out of Maine, and again was a whole family situation. And in that case, the judge said that the standard that he was going to use for lesbian mothers was identical to the standard that he used, which not all judges use, for a family where the mother and the father were not legally married to each other, the mother and the new man were not legally married to each other, but were living in the same home and were raising the children in a family-type situation, and that he would explore into that to the extent of looking to see whether this was a stable family situation that was providing a healthy environment for the children with a lot of love and concern. And if he found that, then the issue of lesbianism became irrelevant. And I wish we had some more decisions like that. What the golden rule for us of lesbian mother cases is stay out of court. In Philadelphia, there has been one case that was won on record, and that was only under the judge's stipulation that the mother moved the lover out of her house. We, like Jennifer was talking about, advise our mothers to bargain with their husbands. Frequently, lesbian mothers will give up support payments in exchange for being able to keep their children. Another thing that we will do sometimes to try and win a case is we build a really big case, and fortunately a lot of lawyers still believe that if they put lesbianism into the initial pleadings, that they have a case already won, and that obviously the judge is going to remove the children, and so they don't bother any further than that. They just bring the husband into court, and that's it. And we arrive with a barrage of expert witnesses and witnesses, character witnesses, et cetera, and the lawyer gets to the door and sees this array. His face falls apart, and he advises the father to bargain right there, not even go before the judge. Partly, I imagine, he doesn't want his client to see what a rotten deal he's just given him.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'd like to talk a little about myths, because Jennifer was talking about myths. There are several myths that are used in the courtroom against the lesbian mother. Well, first of all, judges are becoming more sophisticated. They've heard about gay rights bills, and they know there's a constitutional issue. So now they're trying to duck, and they'll find some other issue to award the children and try not to raise the issue of lesbianism. But there are cases on records where judges have expressed a great deal of voyeurism. When you go into court with a lesbian mother, the judge is seeing, usually for the first time in his life, a real live lesbian right there, and they say some incredible things to her, including, what do you do in bed?
Jesus.
Some of the myths are that lesbians make love in front of their children. That's coupled with two myths around lesbians. One is that they're obviously frigid women, or so ugly that they couldn't get a man. And the other is that they're absolutely and totally sexual. And when I first started talking about gay rights in Philadelphia, and I've been a gay rights activist for a long time, I remember one audience once where someone asked, what do lesbians do during the day? And I sometimes feel that judges are asking that question in their heads when you go into court. So they feel that obviously lesbians make love all day in front of their children. Another myth is that, and it's a very strong belief, that lesbians will raise homosexual children. There is no basis for this, since all of the lesbians I know come out of heterosexual homes, and no study has ever been done on lesbians raising children in lesbian homes, because if they're lucky enough to be doing that, they certainly are very secret about it, because if anyone finds out, they're likely to lose the children. So that there is no basis for this particular myth. Another myth is that lesbians molest their children. That goes along with the homosexual myth that all homosexuals are just dying to molest children. And another thing, until very recently, was that all homosexuality is a mental illness, and certainly the psychiatry profession had put this out and has only recently started to take it off their list of mental illnesses. So there you had a woman coming into court who's obviously mentally ill. Why would you award children to her? And another problem is that a lot of psychologists will come into court and testify that obviously in this home with these two mothers raising the children and no male figure, the children are going to have terribly confused role models. And again, at least from my experience, if you are raising a male child in an all-female home, you would encourage the mother, I'm sure Jennifer will support this, to make sure that there are male role models somewhere in that child's life, and they do not have to be right in the home and in the kitchen. There's been a recent study by Bernice Goodman, which we use a lot in our cases, which was a study of a group of lesbian mothers against a control group of heterosexual mothers in group therapy. She found out that the lesbian mothers come from as wide and diverse a background as heterosexual mothers, that there are as many good lesbian mothers and bad lesbian mothers as there are heterosexual mothers, that the only difference she could find was that lesbian mothers tended to feel guilty if they were living with a lover around the kind of thing that mixed racial families have problems with, that is, that other kids on the block find out about it and tease about it. And the recent major case of Mary Jo Risha that was in all the papers where she lost her children, I think that was almost the deciding factor with the jury, was that one of the children said that he had been teased around her being a lesbian. Goodman feels that once she gets mothers beyond this feeling of guilt and to understand that you cannot be responsible for those kinds of things, all you can do is encourage a child to be able to deal with the situation when it arises. I mean, it can happen certain ages with children. I know, at least from my own experience, my child would like me to be slim and straight, not just straight. So there are a lot of things that children have to overcome, and you have to adjust your children to the world as it really is. And the other thing she did find, and this very much speaks to what Jennifer was talking about, is that lesbian mothers, now this is a either a lesbian mother living alone with her children or living with a lover with her children, tend to present a more positive role model, because frequently a woman who is married, and this is the woman who is invested everything in child rearing and sees herself only validated by her children, tends to be very neurotic kind of personality, very childlike personality. That's terribly putting down children, I can't think of a synonym. Whereas the lesbian mother, being on her own and knowing she's going to be on her own and knowing that she's not going to be attached to a man and is not going to have the economic benefits that accrue to reattaching yourself to a man, which is what a lot of divorced women do, tends to give the children a very positive, strong image of women, and along with that a very positive image of what a full human being can be.
Thank you, Rosalie.
Most comprehensive project for women. Experience award-winning films, photo exhibits, a children's corner, an information center, and lunchtime discussions. It's located on the ground floor of the Penn Walt Building, 17th and the Parkway, in the heart of the city of sisterly love. Open 10 to 6 daily. For more information, please call 04-1560.
See her.